And I got up there, and it was a wonderful convention, but she wasn't speaking until Sunday at noon. And the people I went with, the person I went with, had to be back. Their Al-Anon needed them back in Portland. And I was real disappointed, and I was kind of pouting on the way back, and he looked at me and he said, "God damn it, Louie, if you stay sober long enough, I'm sure you'll run into her." And 2 days ago, I did. I was fortunate enough to be one of the people to pick her up at the Portland International Airport here, and she's given a lot to me already. And I'm sure I'm going to get more, and so are all you. I'd like this time to introduce Dottie S.
Thanks. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Dottie Shore. Hi.
Hi, Dottie.
This is really a wonderful occasion for me. You know, the only reason I don't like to be called an old-timer is because it sounds like Alzheimer's. And I'm not an old-timer, I'm a long-timer. And I'm a miracle. And you're a miracle. And let's thank God. I think Max is a special miracle. I have known Max and Paul a long time, and I've watched Paul star all the time, and he is a star, and I love him dearly, and I've seen Max sit there and squirm whenever he talked, because he blames everything on Max. And Max gets sober in Al-Anon, and wasn't that one hell of a talk she gave tonight? Kind of scares me, those Al-Anons. I think they're creeping up on us, kids. We're going to have to watch. Anybody here from Texas?
No. One.
You know, I had the privilege of speaking in Texas at their 40th anniversary. And do you know Texans speak funny? They say I listen funny. But they do. They're always fixing to do something, but they never get it done. And then they all say, "I reckon." And they're always wrecking something, but I don't know what that is either. But the reason I'm telling you this is that when I got ready to leave that Sunday morning to go to the airport, a good-looking dude walked through the door, and I mean he was a Texan. He had a silver buckle that big, you know, right here, and a cowboy hat and boots, and I said to my hostess, "My God, introduce me to him." So she said, "Have you met Dottie?" And he looked me up and down, and he said, "Well, we've howdied, but we ain't shook yet." So I howdied and we shook from then on. It was wonderful. You know, I've been privileged to be sober quite a while, one day at a time. And when you hear the 12 steps read over and over and over, and the traditions read over and over, and chapter 3, if you're not careful, you'll go someplace in your mind while they're doing that. Anybody here ever guilty of that? And one night here several years ago when I came to myself and all of a sudden realized they'd completed all the reading and I hadn't heard a word, and my higher power says to me, "Hey, dummy." Well, he didn't say dummy, but that's the way I thought he did. He said, "You better start listening. That's what got you sober." So I started listening and I heard some remarkable things. The first thing I heard is someone say, "The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop stinking." I thought that was very interesting. Then I heard someone say, "Animosity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions." And later someone read, "Many of us exclaimed, 'What an odor, I can't go through it.'" Now, please believe me, I'm not making fun of anyone, because I'm sure I'll say something and someone will tell me later what I said. But these people read and go right on. They don't even know they said these things. And it just tickles me. But it sure makes me listen, because I collect these things now. There's a kid about 3 weeks sober, a young man. He was so nervous. He was literally shaking up there, and he came to the part and he said, "What, an order? I can't go through with that." And then I was to hear a woman say, "Humbly asked him to restore our shortcomings." But I really think I heard the tops. Here about, oh, a couple months ago, I heard a person get up and say, "Our leaders are but twisted servants. They do not get them." Oh. Years ago, you heard the one sought through prayer and medication. I'm sure you heard that one. Anyhow, that's kind of a defense mechanism. You know, when I get you laughing, I get my second wind. And I've been waiting one hell of a long time up here. You know that, don't you? I've been waiting for months to do this. I love it. And I love especially being asked to speak at the young people's meetings. And I know you won't believe it, but you know I was a young people once? I really was a young people. In fact, when I joined AA, they said, "You're too young to be an alcoholic." And I was in my late 20s. So you just don't know. I heard a beautiful girl talk today. She came into the program at 14. She's now 3 years sober, and she has a baby 2 years old. And she's beautiful. And I thank God for that, that the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is being taken out, that we know now that we're not bad people who drink too much. We drink too much and do bad things. Oh, thank God. Thank God for that. I'm going to share with you a little bit of what I've learned about the filthy, stinking, rotten, cunning, baffling, powerful, killer, terminal illness that we call alcoholism. And you know, it's a strange disease. No place in the world can you be as sick as we are and have so damn much fun. And brag about being crazy. And we are crazy, you know that, don't you? I'm glad you are, because if you weren't crazy, I couldn't belong. I just would never be identifying here. At any rate, Dr. Bob and Bill and Dr. Silkworth came up with the idea that we had an allergy of the body, and I think that's an excellent term. Because an allergic reaction is a bad reaction to something taken in the mouth, breathed through the nostrils, or touched against the skin. And so the word allergy is really a good word. But several years ago, I think about 15 years ago, I read a paper from the Yale Institute on Alcoholic Studies that was to change my whole feeling about the disease of alcoholism, and was so helpful, and I hope that it'll help you. It seems like they took six. They wanted to find out what the difference was between an alcoholic's body and a non-alcoholic's body. So they took six alcoholics and hospitalized them until by blood count and urinalysis, the alcohol was out of their system. They asked for six non-alcoholic volunteers. They gave the 12 people a pint of whiskey to drink, and they waited 24 hours from the last drink and began testing again. Now, in every one of the non-alcoholics, they found it either out of the body totally or in the bladder, ready to be passed out into the urine. It showed them that the alcohol had burned up, oxidized, gone through the kidneys, bladder, and out in the urine. However, and oh dear ones, this is so important, in every one of the alcoholics, they found it in the spinal fluid. Now they say, and I don't know today if they know the gland that fails to burn the alcohol up, but we have a gland that either does not function from beginning, as it did in my case, I was alcoholic from drink one, or you can have good drinking time and this gland fails and you go across the line into alcoholism and the gland will never repair itself. A great deal like the pancreas and the diabetic. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And when I personally, as an alcoholic, take alcohol in any form, even NyQuil, God, that would be an awful way to get drunk, wouldn't it, on NyQuil? It doesn't oxidize, burn up. It goes into my bloodstream, to my spinal fluid, and to my brain. Now, they said the first part of my brain that's affected is in the front of my head, and it contains the I care factor, and that's sedated immediately. That's why one drink is too much and 1,000 aren't enough. Now, no way, no how are we ever going to be able to change that. I worked in pharmacy for some 23 years, and I would have diabetic people come up to my counter, and they would be either angry or crying because they've been diagnosed as diabetic, and rightly so. That is a dread disease. And they must change their whole way of life. But I'd notice about 2 weeks later, they'd come back to the counter, they'd be picking up their insulin or their needles, and they had pretty well accepted their idea that this was a disease, and if they followed certain rules, they could handle it and live comfortably. Dear ones, why can't we do that? Why can't you come here to this meeting or to your small meetings and learn that it is not a moral weakness, that you're not a no-good bum, that you have a physical allergy that you can never, ever overcome, and maybe cry a little bit and say, what am I going to do Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's? And get angry. But pretty soon, in a few short weeks, say, well, that's the breaks. Why can't we do that? Because we have a part of our disease that no other disease has. Now, tuberculosis can only be arrested. Diabetes can only be arrested. Many of these diseases can only be arrested. Alcoholism cannot be cured. It can only be arrested. But we have a part of our disease that no other disease under the God's earth, as heaven, can be done. And it's called the obsession of the mind. This thing up here that the doctors don't understand, the ministry doesn't understand, our family doesn't understand, and most of all, we don't understand. And it says, somehow, some way, I'm going to control and enjoy this drinking. This time it's going to be different. The great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow, some way, someday, we're going to control and enjoy our drinking. The delusion is astonishing. Many will pursue it at the gates of insanity and death. And loved ones, I have pursued alcoholism to the gates of insanity and death, so I know what I'm talking about. This is a dread disease. Now, supposing all of us in this room had been diagnosed today as either having AIDS or cancer, and you were told, I can't do anything about this thing. We can arrest it, but we can't cure it. On the contingency that you'll go to a meeting 3 or 4 times a week, drink some lousy coffee, sit on some hard chairs and lie to each other a little bit. And we can arrest this disease. Dear God, there wouldn't be meeting places for the people. Do you think they'd say, it's too cold? It's too hot? Oh, it's raining out? There's a good television program on. I don't like the speaker. No, not if you thought for 1 minute those dread diseases would break out. We have a worse disease because, see, we're our own doctors. And yet so many people that I've known have gone down the drain because they had a resentment against the leader or the secretary, or they didn't want to be where it smoked. So much smoke. Oh, my God, I can't stand the smoke. You know, I gave up alcohol and cigarettes and sex, and it was the worst 5 minutes of my whole life. Oh, I stole that. You know I stole that. I heard that recently. I thought, I got to get that in. I think that's the funniest crack I ever heard. Well, I did give up cigarettes and alcohol, but it's none of your business what I did with the other one. Anyhow, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time on February the 8th, 1950. That was 35 and a half years ago. I was only 8 years old, of course, when I got here. I had 19 years of drinking. Alcoholism, really, periodic. I never drank a beer on a hot afternoon. I never had a cocktail before dinner. I don't know what in the world they were talking about. I always said, let's get drunk, let's get smashed, let's tie one on. Take me from here in this body of pain, over here, any place, I didn't care how I got there. And that's all I ever wanted to do. The last 4 and a half years of my drinking were chronic. Around the clock. Never drunk, never sober. They say alcoholics don't have willpower. I ended up taking 5 and 6 straight shots down in the morning and vomit them all back up before one would stay down. And then I was fine. I'd get my kids off to school, do my housework, buy my groceries. There came a time when alcohol turned on me and started to kick the hell out of me. I went through hallucinations and blackouts. I went through terrors like I've never known, only as I started to withdraw. See, I never had a hangover. I would have the vomits in the morning trying to get one down, but I never had the headaches or any of that. As I tried to withdraw from alcohol, I went through terrors. I had hallucinations. I became a secret drinker the last couple of years of my drinking. I would see people with their eyes up like this looking in the window. I went around, pulled the window shades down, take a drunk, went down and pulled them all up. I was the tartest drunk that ever got to AA. You know, you can't keep pulling that window shade up and down and drinking all day without getting pretty tired. But at any rate, it was terrible. I saw foam coming through the hardwood floors. I had such terror, I can't tell you. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous in a blackout. Now, I had a sister 2 years older than I am, radio singer, junior champion skier, and a model. And her alcoholism progressed faster than mine. She was a fifth-a-day drinker, a bar type, did a lot of things, and she was an alcoholic. The last time I saw her, I called her a dirty alcoholic, because I thought an alcoholic was a dirty word, too. But it was the only time it ever entered my mind that maybe my problem was that I drank too much. Not because I didn't have enough money, I couldn't buy my kids pajamas when it was cold, that I was not happy. All the excuses I ever used for drinking, maybe it wasn't that. Maybe I was an alcoholic. So I tried to stop drinking the month of January of 1950. And that month of January was the most hell I've ever been through. And in a blackout, I called North Hollywood, and someone answered AA Clubhouse. And I said to her, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? And she said, is it for you or your husband? I said, it's for my husband, of course. And then I started to cry and blubber, as only alcoholic can cry and blubber. And she said, don't kid me, it's for you, isn't it? And I said, yes. Yeah. She said, I'll be right out. I said, you can't do that. I don't want my husband to know I'm an alcoholic. She said she thought she had a drunk and a ding-a-ling, and she was right. She said, I'll come out tomorrow morning on one condition, that you're not drinking. If you're drinking, I'll leave. I want to talk to you and not the bottle. And the next morning, I got up and got my kids off to school, and I didn't take the drink, and I walked, and I shook, and I died. And at 9 o'clock, she got there. And she explained to me that I had an illness, and I thought you had the greatest cop-out I'd ever heard. But if that's what you're going to do, and then people are going to get off my back, that's going to be great. Now, I really thought all this time that I was crazy. I did not think I was alcoholic. Isn't an alcoholic a woman who's in a bar soliciting for a drink? Yeah. That's a Freudian slip.
I got it down.
And she's got a dirty house and hungry kids. That's an alcoholic woman. And an alcoholic man surely is down on Skid Row in L.A. with holes in his shoes and wine bottles. So I drank 2 years longer than I'd had to because I was not an alcoholic. I knew I was crazy. Well, she came out and called and talked to me that day and talked all afternoon. And she told me I must go to a meeting. And I said, I can't do it because I don't want my husband to know. And she said, the first words I ever heard, this is a program of rigorous honesty, and you've got to tell him the truth. So I said, well, I won't go tonight. I'll go tomorrow night. So he came home, and I set him down in a chair with his back to me. I'm not dramatic. I want you to understand all this. And I said, I have something important to tell you. And he said, what? I said, I'm an alcoholic and called AA. And his shoulders start to go like this. And I said, oh, God, please don't laugh. And he turned around and looked up at me with tears and said, oh, thank God. I was getting the papers ready for Camarillo State Hospital. Oh, thank God. Thank God I called AA, because if they'd locked me up, I know you'd have lost my mind, because my mind was going anyhow. And my fear of insanity was so great. So I went to a meeting on, I guess it was about February the 10th, and I walked in expecting to see people like my sister. Now, she had developed cirrhosis of the liver. Her stomach had swelled the size of a 9-month pregnancy. Her face has swelled. She has dirty blue jeans on and a maternity jacket, and she's running the streets of Reno, our hometown, like a bum. This is a radio singer, champion skier, a model. And that's what I thought I was coming to see that night. And I saw beautiful people just like you, and I couldn't believe it. But let me tell you something. That night, I fell into the worst trap that I could have fallen into. And I'm sad to say the man who spoke that night was a great deal to blame, if there be blame. He gave us 55 minutes of a drunkalogue. He told me how many fifths a day he drank. He'd been in a sanitarium, he'd been in jail, he'd lost total 5 cars, lost his family, and that's all I heard. And I'm sitting there thinking, my God, I scared myself into this thing. I didn't drink that long, that much, I didn't do those things. Maybe I'm only a little alcoholic. You can't be a little pregnant, did you know that? But I tried to identify with a drinking pattern, and if there's anyone here new, don't try to identify with my pattern, because I have an odd pattern. But please identify with my thinking pattern. Because had I identified with anybody's thinking pattern, I would have been on safe ground. But I ended up thinking, my God, I'm not an alcoholic. Now, when I walked through the doors of North Hollywood, I weighed 82 pounds. I was suffering from malnutrition. My lips were split and bleeding here from vitamin deficiency. I was unemployable. I couldn't drive a car on the freeway. I couldn't arrange my hair or buy a dress by myself. I was a total basket case. And yet when I walked through the doors of North Hollywood, they came up to me and they said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, I think so. And dear God, they put their warm arms around me and they totally accepted me as I was for the first time in my life. Not as I would be, could be, or should be, but as I was that night. And they gave me a gift called agape love. That's spelled A-G-A-P-E, God's kind of love. Unconditional. They didn't care what I looked like, where I'd been, how much money I had, what kind of a car I drove. They loved me and totally accepted me. And see, you've done that here. You people have been so lovely to me this weekend. Many of you, I've led retreats up in Portland. Portland loves me, do you know? I go up here all the time. I love it. I love you. I love it. Thank you. I've led two retreats for 65 men and Dottie. And I told the last group if they didn't make a pass at me before I left, I was going to blow my head off, but it was all right. I've led a lot of ladies' retreats up here, and I've done a lot of speaking, and I love it very much. And many people have come up to me this weekend and given me agape love and said, I've heard your tape, or I've heard you talk, and I love you. And one girl said today, we had a lovely meeting this morning, and she came up and said, you know, we were talking at the meeting about what you want to be when you grow up, and she said, Dottie, sure, I want to be like you when I grow up. And it made me cry. I can't tell you what that means to me. Who, me? Dumb? Stupid? Ineffectual? Dottie? You want to be like me? Well, that isn't me anymore. That was me. That's what you got. That's what you took. That's what you loved. That's what you had patience with. That is the miracle we're talking about tonight. This is a meeting of miracles. Look at me, darlings. I am a total miracle, and you must take the credit, because I can't. Now, in 1950, it was like a men's stag group. There was more men than there were women. And they told me that night when I got there that I looked like I was too young to be an alcoholic, which is an awful thing to tell anybody. Pain is pain is pain is pain. And they'll say, well, I'm glad you didn't have to suffer as long as I did. Oh, come on. Come on. I don't care if you suffer 5 minutes or 5 years. Pain is pain is pain. But at any rate, I thought I was older than God when I got here, but they thought I looked pretty young, and they kept saying, isn't she cute, and isn't she a nice newcomer? Well, of course, I love that. I wish you'd do that a little bit more now. It'd really be nice. When I spoke in Montreal at the old-timers meeting, that's when I said, you know, call me a long-timer. Never mind about that old-timer business. But, you know, I don't care. I'm not 1 minute younger or 1 minute older than God wanted me to be. And it's wonderful that I'm alive and here. Well, they didn't have very many women speakers. And they found out I had this gift of gab. Now, you didn't know that, I hadn't told you. Huh? And they put me on the circuit when I was 49 days dry. And I spoke from Bakersfield to San Diego and from Riverside to Santa Barbara and any place in between. I went to 365 meetings the first year. My family quieted down. My weight came back on. I became employable 3 months after I was sober, went back to work in a pharmacy. I tell you, I was just so happy. At least I thought I was happy. Now, happiness is a quiet thing. It's a byproduct of right living. I was in a perpetual state of excitement. The A book says we're used to three things: excitement, anxiety, and depression. Right? Peace of mind and a quiet heart, we have to learn. We have to earn it. We don't know it. And I had the adrenaline shooting through me. I held on a 40-hour week job. I went out every night. I took care of two kids and a husband and an apartment. And I never got tired. It was just railing through me. Now, I believe, and you don't have to agree with me, that we're split personalities right down the middle. This side of my personality says, you're so dumb, Dottie, and you're so stupid, and my God, if they find out about you, they'll kick you out of here. But this side of my personality says, you're so gorgeous, baby, and you give such a talk. And if they just really knew how wonderful you were, you know. And the old pendulum swings back and forth, and we get thrown off balance. Well, I was stuck over here on the inferiority side, and the pendulum started swinging to the middle. They didn't stay there. It shot to the egocentric side of my personality. And when they started telling me how wonderful I was, I agreed with them. I thought, my God, I've been looking for you people all my life. Now, I have a real gift. I had a gift once that was even phenomenal. It was called Total Recall Memory. I could pick up this page and read it and give it back to you, common period. And that's gone. Alcohol took care of it. But I do have a pretty good photographic memory. And my sponsor was a book woman, and she memorized the book. And she would quote it, and so they were impressed with her, and I'd go home and memorize the same thing. I was constantly saying on page 56, on page 75, and everybody was terribly impressed with me. So I memorized it, I read it, I recited it, I preached it, I taught it, I did everything but work it. And I know you're way ahead of me. Well, I wanted that first year, and I had sat in an audience and watched my sister on that stage getting roses for singing, cups for skiing, modeling. Then I had a baby sister 9 years younger, and she got all the attention. And so I'm sitting there in that first meeting that first night, and they had the birthday cake celebration. And the ladies were dressed beautifully, and they had flowers on. And I made a vow that I just wouldn't drink for a year, and then I'd be up on the stage getting my cake, and you'd be down there looking up at me, and I'd have my night on the stage. So I really stayed dry for a year. I didn't know I was just dry. I took everybody else's inventory. I never took my own. I did everything with the program but work it, and I thought I was doing all right. Well, the year went by on the wings. On February 8, 1951, I stood at the platform at North Hollywood. I had rehearsed my acceptance speech for 6 months. You should have heard it. It was wonderful. Had a corsage stuck out about that big. My family sat in the front row, and they gave me more presents than I'd ever gotten any natal birthday. And again, they told me how wonderful I was, and again, I agreed. And I think I thought I graduated that night. I'm an old-timer now, you know. Got a year. I didn't mind being called an old-timer in those days. That was wonderful. But I was tired, and the postnatal blues set in. And the adrenaline starts to leave, and I'm tired. And besides, I'm an old-timer now, you understand? So I decided I'd break my meeting pattern, and I'd go on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Well, I'd go on Tuesday, and then if Thursday night came along, it was raining, or it was hot, or it was a television program, and I didn't go. And I'd go back the following Tuesday, and do you know something? Nobody rushed the door to ask me where the hell I'd been. Boy, these are ungrateful people. They'd worked me for a whole year, then throw me away this way. Well, I'd call my sponsor, and she wouldn't give me 2 hours of undivided attention on the phone anymore. She's working with newcomers. She said to me during this time, "You better get rid of your resentments." I said, "Resentments? I don't have resentments. I have justifiable anger." My God, yes. And I'm off balance. Now, had I taken an inventory, I would have found out one thing about it. See, alcoholism is but a symptom of a deeper-seated problem. And dear ones, you don't have to agree with me, but if you put the cork in the bottle and you don't take care of your deeper-seated problem, you will become a compulsive overeater, an addict, sexually promiscuous. You know, if you can't fill one hole, you're going to fill the other. That's true. I'm sorry. You can become a compulsive spender, compulsive sleeper, compulsive worker. You will find something else, some dirty bandage to put on your wound. We're wounded right here. When I came to AA, I had all these dirty bandages on me. Oh, I had sex and marriage and kids and divorce and money and property and prestige. Had I allowed you, you could have ripped those off and put a clean bandage on me called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I could have gotten well from the inside out. But I just scabbed over, because I did not find my deeper-seated problem. And I know now that one of them was a neurotic need for attention. After I got a little bit well, I found out that I was a pathological liar, that I exaggerated, that I would fall down if necessary. I would mispronounce words. I was a buffoon. I would do anything in the world if you'll just notice me. So you can imagine what heady stuff this was for me, how intoxicating indeed, when I came into you and you patted me on the back and you built me up. It was better than any drunk I'd ever been on. Now, it's starting to go. And you guys aren't making a fuss over me anymore. And I'm off balance. And what am I going to do? Well, I've learned that I am a neurotic. Not only alcoholic, but I'm neurotic. A neurotic is a person who makes decisions that are destructive to themselves. How many neurotics we got out here tonight? And the only thing wrong with being a neurotic is if you don't admit it. That's all. When I couldn't say I was alcoholic, you know, it didn't help me. When I can't say I'm a neurotic, it isn't going to help me. Once I admitted I was alcoholic, I could do something. Once I knew I was a neurotic, that I made decisions based upon destructive decisions that were of interest to me, then I was not so prone to do these destructive decisions. But during this time now, I had to make a decision that was so destructive that it very nearly took my life. I had learned the other day the difference between a psychotic and a neurotic. A psychotic says 2 and 2 are 5. A neurotic says 2 and 2 are 4, and I can't stand it. I'm neurotic. So I thought, well, I always punished Al. Every time I'd get mad, I'd get drunk at him. Well, now I'm mad at North Hollywood, the whole group. So I'm going to get drunk at the whole group, and I'm going to fix them, and they're going to be sorry when they lose this old-timer. 16 months and 3 days, old-timer. So I went into total fantasy, and I thought, well, I know I'm going to get sick, but I'm not going to drink too much. I'm not going to drive, and I'm not going to get in trouble, because the door to AA swings both ways, and I'll just get drunk, and then I can get back to AA. I'll get your attention. I'll punish you. You'll be sorry, and everything will be fine. So I went into fantasy in my mind, and I thought, well, let's see now. Al will come home and find me drunk. He's going to raise hell, but I don't care. I'm not going to hide the bottle. I'm going to put it right on in the coffee table, put my feet up there, and when he comes home, I'll tell him to go to hell. But he rushes to the phone, he calls North Hollywood, and he's saying, oh, my God, Dottie's drunk. And they're saying, oh, no. And they get in a caravan of cars and come over and 12-step me. And when they get there, they make amends, and I forgive them. You thought alcohol was my problem, didn't you? And they kiss and make up, and they take me in their warm arms. They take me back to North Hollywood, and I'm a newcomer again. So on June the 11th, 1951, I got up that morning. I cleaned my house. I wasn't going to have them call any slob. I put on my earrings and my makeup. As I got ready to leave the house, I remembered my mother always saying, be sure and have clean underwear on. So I put clean underwear on because something always happened when I drank. And I walked to the liquor store and I bought the same half pint. Now, I want you to realize I'm 16 months and 3 days circus speaker. I hope you're impressed. I sure was. I was so impressed it almost killed me. And I bought the same half pint and I came home. Now, let me tell you about non-alcoholics. You know they're ferrets. They can find a bottle faster than anybody I've ever seen in my life. If you lose a bottle, just get an Al-Anon. They'll come in, they'll find it, and nothing flat. I swear they will. They will. You know that. Well, my husband used to find the bottle, hold me at arm's length, and pour it down the sink. We were very poor, very broke. I would have to get my drinking money out of my grocery money and still feed my family. Now, if he'd pour the bottle down the sink, that meant I'd have to get up the next morning with the dry heaves, get those two kids off to school, get him out of there, get enough pennies put together to walk to that damn liquor store and buy that bottle. So I had to protect my supply. You understand. You sympathize with me, don't you? All right. So I'm looking all over. And I looked up one day, and here's the vinegar bottle. Did you know vinegar and bourbon are the same color? So I took the vinegar out of the bottle, poured it out of the sink, put the vinegar in the whiskey in the vinegar bottle, and I put it right up in the front of the cupboard. Al would come home and find me a little drunk. He'd go looking. He'd move that vinegar bottle back and forth. He never did find it. I wish I could tell you I was a fancy drunk, but I drank out of a vinegar bottle for 2.5 years. Isn't that great? Fancy drunk. Now it's different. It's going to be different. You understand this? I went home, uncorked the bottle, took the vinegar down, poured it under the sink, put the whiskey in the vinegar bottle, and took my first drink out of the vinegar bottle, and I'm 16 months and 3 days circuit speaker. That's how much I changed. I knew all about AA. You understand that, don't you? And the book says, head knowledge alone is not enough. Oh, I can quote you the book, the traditions. I can tell you. You want to know something about AA? Ask me. If you don't, I'll tell you about it anyhow. Knew all about it. It doesn't help. Now, the A book says, our life becomes an open book to one other human being. Secrets will kill us. I broke all the rules, darlings. My life wasn't an open book to one other human being. I told a little bit to everybody, but not to one. My secret was that I'm not an alcoholic, and I never told anybody for fear you'd kick me out and not let me stay here. But I did not believe I was an alcoholic. Crazy, yes. Alcoholic, no. And I think that's why, in my sickness, I was stupid enough to say, I'll have a little drunk and then I'll come back to AA. Well, I took my first drink out of the vinegar bottle, and if someone had slapped me like this and waken me out of a sleepwalk, it couldn't have been more violent. Please believe me, that was the first realization, really, that I had that I'd taken a drink. I was mentally drunk up here long before I ever took that drink. When you reach for the drink, been gone a long time before then. And when that whiskey burns my throat, I think, oh, my God, what did I do? There goes 16 months of sobriety shot to hell. And I loved you people. God, you have no idea how much I loved you, how much I needed your love, how much I needed your hugs and your acceptance. And I realized, what had I done? I had thrown it away. And I stood there frightened, waiting for something to happen. And I waited, and I waited, and nothing happened. And I thought, oh, Lord, I knew all along I wasn't like those drunks over at North Hollywood. And I went out in the kitchen to have what I thought was going to be my second drink. And what I tell you now was told to me by my husband and my sponsor. The window shade came down. I remember one drink. My God, what have I done? Walked out to the kitchen to get the second drink, and that's all. It was like the lights went out. Now, Al was an outside salesman, and he knew I was squirreled up. There was no Al-Anon in those days. And I was saying things like, I might as well be drunk as the way I am. Those SBs don't appreciate me. I'm griping and complaining. And he knew I'd changed back to the way I was before I called you people. So he knocked off the territory, thank God, came home and heard me screaming a half a block before he got to the house. I'd never had the screaming memes before. Please remember, this is a progressive disease, and it progresses even when you're dry. Most people think you pick up where you left off. Not so. Not so. I had never had the screaming memes. When he opened the door, I was on the front room floor, kicking and beating my heels till I almost broke the bones in my feet. I dry heaved till I broke a blood vessel into my esophagus, and I'm vomiting blood. I retched till I broke the blood vessels in my eyes, and there's nothing but white slits. As he tried to get me up off the floor and put me on the couch, I went totally limp. Now, loved ones, remember, in 1951, there was no care unit, there was no hospital, there was no insurance company that would touch you with a 10-foot pole. You were nothing but a dirty alcoholic. You must remember that. And my husband, in terror, we'd only lived in the house for a few months. We just bought this house. And he remembered that on the corner, two blocks from where we lived, was a medical center. There were 7 doctor suites along a sidewalk. And he just ran out there. He got into the first doctor's office, and the office was full of people. He went past the people and to the doctor's receptionist, and she was busy. Now, he shot past her, and if you'd have to know my ex-husband to know how shy the man was. And he was so terrorized, he went past the receptionist into the doctor's examining room, grabbed the doctor by the hands and said, "My God, come quickly. My wife's been drinking 16 months and she's dying." And the doctor told me later, he knew he was telling the truth somehow. And without word one, he left his office full of people, picked up his black bag, and ran 2 blocks back to my home. And do you know why? He was an alcoholic. Coincidence? Complicated way of spelling God. When he got there, I was on the floor. He put the stethoscope on my chest. He turned to Alan. He said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Shore, we're too late. There is no heartbeat, no pulse, no respiration. The alcohol had gone into my bloodstream and repressed my respiratory tract." And I was pronounced dead of alcoholism on June 11th, 1951. And the only reason I'm here tonight with you loved ones is by the grace of God. And that sentence, "by the grace of God," is kind of pushed around too easy. And the literal meaning of grace of God means a free, unearned, unmerited, unwarranted gift. And I was granted the free, unearned, unmerited, unwarranted gift of sobriety when I was on the floor bleeding to death and dying. I can't take credit for my sobriety. No human power relieved my alcoholism, but God could and would if sought. And I'm sure my husband must have prayed when he was running. Now, the doctor said when Al got hysterical, and just because he thought he'd have to do something to show him, he took a needle about that long out of his bag, shot me directly in the chest cavity, gave me artificial resuscitation, and truly, by the grace of God, my heart started beating. Let's take it back. Suppose Al had been a minute late coming home. The doctor had waited 2 minutes. They could have brought my heart back, but my brain would have been damaged beyond repair. I am alive and well on the planet Earth by the grace of God. Thank God. The total sum of alcohol I had that morning was 3 straight shots of whiskey. Is it how much you drink? Is it how long you drink? Is it what brand? Is it with whom? Does that constitute alcoholism? No. Can you guarantee what's going to happen when you take your next drink? I thought I could. I'm going to get sick. I'd come back. I believe when we walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're presented with some invisible pieces of paper. You maybe have 1, 2, 5, 10. I don't know how many you got. I call it sobering up time. And I punched my last ticket. I don't have any return ticket. I got another drunk in me, and you've all got another drunk in you. But you don't know if you have a return ticket coming. Oh, God, how many funerals I've gone to. Women have a tendency to burn themselves up. I found little piles of ashes. 3 of them have done that. My last girl, and I hope it's my last, 3 years sober, quit going to meetings, got mad, got drunk, got up on a chair to change a light bulb in the kitchen, fell off the chair, hit the stove, ruptured her spleen, and bled to death before we could get her to the hospital. Another girl broke my record. three drinks and death? You always get talked in AA. I had a baby 2 years sober. She came into AA, got pregnant, the guy split. She quit going to meetings, and for some reason I never gave up on her. I kept talking to her, and I thought, if I am AA, Mrs. AA 4, I don't give a damn. And she'd call me, and I'd call her. And I called her one day, and she didn't answer. She was more of a recluse than I've ever seen. Had this little girl. I called her the next day and that night, and I got scared. And I got another girl, and we went over to the apartment. We asked the manager to let us in. Dear God, she had been dead for 5 days with a little girl, 3 years old, locked up in the apartment with her. The little girl had put a pillow under her head and covered her over with a blanket. They took an autopsy on her, and she had 2 shots of whiskey in her. That's all. Nobody found her. When her respiratory tract had been repressed, they didn't find her. You'll always be talked. It's not how much you drink, not how long you drink, it's not what brand. This is a deadly killer. It will take your mind, or it'll kill you. And if you have a county hospital here like we do down in L.A., go down to the alcoholic ward and see the alcoholic strapped down in a straitjacket screaming their minds away and say, but this time it'll be different. But you understand, I'm not like that. If I ever get that bad, I'll quit. It's not true. It's a killer disease. It's hereditary. It goes in a family. They know now that it's hereditary. It can skip a generation like diabetes, but if you have alcohol in your family, you're prone to it. The last paper I got was they took a couple of newborn babies from known alcoholic fathers and some babies from non-alcoholic fathers and gave them brain tests, and the brain waves of the babies from known alcoholic fathers was different. You can't beat it. You can't beat it. So don't try. But try to find a way to live comfortably without alcohol. So we want the cult of the comfortable. Damn near kill ourselves getting comfortable, don't we? But see, I have to feel comfortable. Now, if AA were no more than giving me all that wonderful head knowledge and telling me to put the cork in the bottle, and then you send me back out there on the street or with my family, you are doing me no favors, and I will crawl on my hands and knees to get drunk tonight. I can't stand... I'm going to tell you what a guy said that I think is so graphic. I can't stand a belly full of ground glass and have a brain hemorrhaging. That sounds pretty dramatic, but you know what he's talking about. I know what a belly full of ground glass feels like. I know what a hemorrhaging brain feels like, don't you? So don't take alcohol away from me, for God's sake, and leave me like that. But please teach me. Please help me to practice these principles in all my affairs. Oh, please tell me what happens when your beloved sister, who's a radio singer, champion skier, and a model, and she dies and blows apart at 39 from alcoholism, and you try to help her and you can't. And tell me how you manage when you go home to Reno to a drunken Irish wake, and everybody in your family gets drunk, and my sister's dead of alcoholism, and they pass the whiskey, and I return it down, and they call me a hypocrite. Tell me how to do that. Don't teach me how to vomit. I'm a past master at vomiting. Don't teach me how to go crazy. I can teach you how to do that. Please teach me how to live comfortably by applying these steps in all my affairs. Tell me what happens when you have a daughter that's an alcoholic addict who smashes her life away. Tell me what happens when you have to take a 10-year-old grandson from her because he's sucking his thumb and wetting the bed and his toenails are growing at the top of his toes from shoes too small. And you get the guardianship papers and she signs it and she's so drunk and so stoned she walks away and she disappears off the face of the earth. You better tell me how to do it then, and I'll tell you who helped me. Al-Anon. God bless Al-Anon. God bless Al-Anon. They helped me save my sanity. Oh, yeah. Better believe it. They taught me the difference between reject, go to hell, and release, go with God. And they helped me. Please tell me what happens when you get up in the morning after all night long going through smothering sensations, waking up and not being able to get your breath. And thinking, God, there's something wrong with my heart or my lungs. And you go to a doctor and he said, Dottie, there's nothing physically wrong. It's emotional. Get yourself to a psychiatrist. And I'm not against psychiatry. I happen to be in private practice myself now for 14 years. And Bill Wilson said one time in the grapevine, if you have a broken arm, don't repeat the 12 steps over it. Take it to a doctor. You do the same thing if you suffer from emotional illness. And the doctor said, there's something emotionally wrong. And I thought I was doing well. I went to Al-Anon. I was spoon-feeding my grandson AA. I was doing all I could. And I found myself, when I left there, crying and going over to an Episcopal priest's house. His wife was my AA baby. And I said, "Father Ken, what do you think's wrong with me?" And he said, "Dottie, obviously you're in a panic. What's wrong?" And I said, "I'm afraid I'll never see Anna alive again." And he said, "You're going to have to accept it. You probably won't." And I screamed in anguish, "My God, I can't." And he said, "Then go on fighting." A book says we cease to fight everything and everybody, including alcohol. The only fight I ever gave up was booze. So I went home and I got on my knees and I said, "Lord God, I don't understand. How can it be your will that I'll never see Anna alive again?" That's God. There's no coincidences and there's nothing odd. That's a complicated way of spelling God. Now, she didn't get well right away, but at least I knew she was alive. And when she did get well, she came back to me to make amends. And I said, "Anne, no sense in that. I'm just grateful you're alive, because I already had you dead. I surrendered you even unto death." And I told her about this day, and she said, "When was it?" And I told her, and she said, "My God, Mother, you know what I was doing that day?" And I said, "I have no idea." Well, she was going into Tijuana, Mexico, to get her drugs. And you could go into Tijuana and pick up 1,000 of anything you wanted. And just before she went through the last time, the Hells Angels had been picked up going across the border. And they had drugs in every pocket. And the feds closed down Tijuana. So when she went in the last time to get her drugs, the pharmacist said, "I'm sorry, can't give you any." Now, it's not like going to another liquor store. And she was burned out. I told you I weighed 82 pounds. I'm 5'2". My daughter's 5'7". She weighed less than 70 pounds. Her capacity was 15 milligram decimals a day, which is enough to kill a horse. And she came back to the valley. She lived right close to us in the San Fernando Valley. And she locked the doors and the windows with towels and blankets. She took the last of her drugs that she had on hand, a huge overdose, turned the gas on and laid down to die. And that afternoon they turned the gas off for lack of payment. Isn't that odd? Another miracle. I could tell you 1,000 miracles. Every day that I'm alive is a miracle. I think people stumble over miracles and don't even know they're there. Now also, please tell me what you do when you go through bankruptcy. And your husband goes into a business with an alcoholic partner. And you beg him not to because you know the man's an alcoholic. And he said, "Anybody that drinks too much you think's an alcoholic." And I said, "It takes one to know one." 9 months later, we're down the tubes. We lost our house, our savings, our cars, everything but an old car and some furniture. How do you stay sober? What step applies? If you can't help me there, baby, you're not helping me at all. And I'm telling you this because I hate it when people get up and tell you a story about how bad it was when they were drinking and they got sober and they sailed off in the sunset. I had that happen when I was first sober, and I went to my sponsor and I said, "Where's my missing link?" She said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, you know this guy chased all over the San Fernando Valley and into Hollywood, talks all the time. Nothing's ever happened to him since he got sober." And she said, "Honey, he doesn't tell you the truth." And so she started telling me some things that were wrong in his life, and God, was I ever grateful. I never thought I'd be so happy to have somebody have so much misery. But he wasn't telling the truth. See, it's nice to have people think, "Oh, we're a wonderful, very well-adjusted member of AA now. We don't have any problems." And that is the most awful disservice you can do to the newcomer. You're going to have trouble, but you don't have to get drunk, and you've got 1,000 people that'll walk with you and hold your hands and hug you and kiss you. Oh, thank God. Thank God. And so my husband went into a decline. He could not take the blow of being bankrupt. He was in Al-Anon 15 years. Most people don't know he started the Alateens. He started the Central Office of Los Angeles. He started the Al-Anouncer, and he was the first intergroup chairman of Southern California. And he worked the program only in the business end. And the day he went through bankruptcy, he walked away and never attended another Al-Anon meeting. And I lasted 8 years watching him compulsively work and compulsively sleep. And I loved him from the time I was 14. I loved him too long to hate him. And I had to leave after 33 years. Tell me how to do that, will you? Tell me how to roll with these things. Oh, you've got to tell me how to take the joy. See, joy is as hard for me to take sometimes as tragedy. Tell me how wonderful it is when some unknown group gives you a paid trip to the Holy Land. How do you receive that without crying your heart out with gratitude? And you walk the path that Jesus walked. Oh, I was a Christian before I went, but I was born again before I got back. I'm an excommunicated Roman Catholic. Excommunicated when I was 16 years old. Walked the face of this earth thinking I was living in adultery and my children were illegitimate. Every time they got sick, God was going to kill them and punish me. And A.A. told me when I first got here that I better get rid of that God. And to pray this prayer for 1 week. God, reveal yourself to me as you really are. And without exaggeration, I prayed that prayer 100 times a day. Now, I came here for sobriety and to stay alive. I didn't know you were going to give me God. I didn't know you were going to give me back Jesus. I didn't know you were going to give me the ability to go to a church of my choice and read the Bible. And I didn't know that when I prayed that prayer, God, reveal yourself to me as you really are, he was going to tell me he wasn't a Catholic. That was the best news I'd ever heard. God's not a Catholic. But listen, God's not a Methodist. God's not a Baptist. God is not religious. Thank God. Thank God he's not religious. Religion is a man-made way of worshiping God. And you get a man in there and you're going to screw it up every time. You know. You know. Oh. Tell me how you handle it when your youngest sister, 9 years younger than you are, that you were practically an unpaid babysitter for, dies of alcoholism. And you try to help her and you can't. Tell me what happens when your mother dies and leaves an elderly father. My father went down to San Jose to live with my younger sister, and her alcoholism progressed, and finally she dies. And my brother-in-law and I put my father in a retirement home, and he was getting along pretty well. And about a year and a half goes by. Now, I didn't know my father. He was an unknown face to me. My mother had totally brainwashed me that everything that was wrong in my life was my father's fault. I didn't stop to see that my father never had an enemy. He was a magnificent man that my mother was not well-liked, and so she had to cut him down. She adored him. She died in his arms. They were married 65 years. But to me, he was a no-good SB. So I didn't have anything to do with my dad. And so my brother-in-law, a year and a half after my sister dies, decides to get married. He tells me to come to San Jose and take my father down here to Southern California. And I thought, my God, 91-year-old man I don't even know. And I travel all over the United States speaking, and I'm in private practice, and I speak all over Southern California. How can I take care of this old man? I can't do it. You know, when I'm against God's will, my gut hurts. I have like a rat in here. And I know there's something wrong because my stomach's hurting me so bad. And I'm saying, God, how can you do this? Look what all I've done for you. Don't you love to talk to God like that? And all of a sudden he says to me, honor thy father and thy mother. And it doesn't mean love or like. It means you will not see them in want. And I knew my father was in want. So I said, all right, I don't understand how it can be your will. But if it's your will, I'll go up and get my dad. You're just going to have to help me do it. Thy will, not mine, be done. And again, that load went off my shoulders. And then I got on PSA and went up to Sunnyvale and picked up my dad. And I brought him back down. I fell in love with him 2 days after he was with me. More loving, delightful, precious person. I had to work through the resentment of my mother. My father had a built-in AA system, and I didn't even know it. He hadn't been with me 3 or 4 days till he got pneumonia. You don't take old people and pull them up like that. I put him in the hospital, and the man next to him a few days later died. And when I called to talk to him that night, they had moved my father, and I knew something had happened. So I rushed over there, and I said, Daddy, does that upset you that he died? He said, Dottie, it was his time. His time had come. I thought, my God, he's got built-in AA, and I didn't even know it. So he got well, and I brought him home, put him in a residential care near me, and he had more pride than I did. And I said, Daddy, I can't take you anyplace. He had gout. He couldn't walk. His brain was wonderfully sharp. I said, if you'll get in a wheelchair, I'll take you around. Well, he thought for about 15 minutes, and he said, all right, let's go for it. I took him to Disneyland, to Marineland, to African Safari. I took him all over, and you never saw anybody enjoy it like my daddy. Now, my granddaughter gave me a great-grandson. And if you want to compliment me after the meeting, just tell me I don't look old enough to be a great-grandmother, will you? But I love it. And my daddy was a great-great-grandfather. Well, the LA Times came out and took a picture of the five generations, and they put it in the paper. You never saw an old man more pleased or more honored in your life. 18th of May comes along. It's my daddy's 92nd birthday. We give him a big party. We have balloons and streamers, and it was wonderful. came time, the whole time just stopped. I wasn't out of town, had no commitments, and it came time for me to go out of town. So my daughter Sandy was going to come and take him out to lunch on Saturday or Sunday, and my daughter Chris, granddaughter Chris, was going to take him on Saturday. So I went to see him, and I said, "Daddy, I'm going out of town, but I'll be back Sunday night." He said, "Don't worry about it, honey. Have a good time." He looked me up and down, because I usually went over there in slacks, and he said, "Damn, but you're a fine-looking woman." Can you imagine me getting that from my dad? I can't tell you what it did. He threw me a kiss, and I left. I called him on Saturday. He was going to go to lunch with Chris. I called him Saturday night. He had a wonderful time. Said he was a little tired. He was going to go to bed. He was going to get up early because he was going to have lunch with Sandy the next day. At 8 o'clock that morning, on June the 10th, my daughter called me, and she said, "Mama, Grandpa's gone. He died this morning." And I had him with me 2 months and 18 days. The most wonderful 2 months and 18 days I ever have with my daddy. Just before he died, I asked for boldness. My father was not a religious man, and I asked for the boldness to witness to the Savior Jesus to him. And my daddy accepted the Lord just before he died. I never could have planned it out or written out a script that would ever have gone through this, ever. Now, he hated his old body. He was a wonderful hunter, wonderful fisherman, and he used to hit himself on the leg and say, "I hate this old body." Well, I got in the car, and I'm coming back home. I was in Palm Springs, which is about an hour, 20 minutes from home. And I'm just saying, "Oh, I wish you could have waited till I got home." And they told me he had just dropped over dead, and God gave me another vision. I saw my father hit the floor. I saw him jump out of that old body and say, "Thank God that's over," and he just floated right out the window to God. Oh, God. Oh, I can't tell you. Well, I was able to let him go, and I know where he is, and I know I'll see him one day. And I learned the most important lesson I think I'll ever learn. Oh, I've learned lessons in AA, the likes of which you never know. But all the lessons that are the most wonderful are the most simple. The first one was let go and let God. Do you know what that means? It means let go and let God. That's what it means. And then I remember this one, and this is the one that I hold to my heart. Because, see, you never know what's going to happen. Oh, you can have good times. You can have bad times. You can have happy times. This is life. And you see, we haven't liked reality. It's so daily. But the thing is that we don't know when we get up in the morning what's going to happen. The only thing I guarantee is that if I do what I did today, I've got an awfully good chance of going to bed sober tonight. But the thing that I've learned is this: no matter what goes down, I have to say, "Father, I don't understand how this can be your will. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. So be it." Thanks for my life. Thank you tonight. Love you.